last we heard, Elisha's been appointed essentially to be the next Navi, or Navi in training next to Eliyahu. And there were other jobs for Eliyahu that he was supposed to do before appointing Elisha. One of those jobs was to go to Aram Damascus, and appoint Hazael, who was the head of the army of Ben-Hadad, is the king of Syria, not Assyria, but Syria. And he was supposed to essentially tell Hazael, who is the general, to take over, and actually take Arnie. I don't know if it may be a little much to leave Arnie's, maybe I should take him off. It's fair enough for the record, but I'm not sure if we should keep a seat for him, although maybe we should. I'll take it. I'm sorry, this is yours. Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry, I thought it was Arnie's. I'll put it back at the end, we never. So we never actually see that Eliyahu does that, but I suppose one of the that is instead of the Eliyahu, in fact, never goes and takes care of Hazael, who's the general of Syria.
How do you know that? Just because it doesn't say that?
No, because we'll see that Elisha does it in about five chapters from now, and it's a pretty miserable story, actually. It's a really, really miserable story. So based on that, we'll know that Eliyahu never gets to it. And we'll also see that Elisha appoints is the one who starts the Yehu rebellion against Ahab's family, which means that was another job that Eliyahu was supposed to do that he simply didn't do. He turned it over to Elisha to do for whatever reason. We'll see. When we take a look at those stories, I think we'll get a sense on why Eliyahu did not want to do it and just got somebody else to do it for him. But the camera shifts back to Ahab, which is where it belongs. I have to be honest, it's a large chapter, and it is a chapter that's very difficult to understand, even with the English translation. I guess the English translation makes it easier, but I'm really just going to step through the chapter, mostly just for comprehension, and there are a few insights, I think, which are important, but mostly I just really want to clarify what's going on here. As far as geopolitically, what we have is Israel has, in its southern border, it has Yehuda. Now, Yehuda is friendly. We haven't found out that yet, by the way. Yehoshaphat is the king of Yehuda at the time, but we haven't met him yet. He's really not been a player. Not only that, Yehoshaphat, the king of Yehuda, will wind up trading kids. They'll marry into the family of the northern king, that is Ahab. Yehoshaphat will marry his son to the daughter or granddaughter of Ahab. I can't remember which. We'll see, and I think there's a little confusion of the issue on exactly it sets up. However, Yehuda has a peace treaty, as far as we know. If you remember, there was a peace treaty with Yehuda and Syria. Now, when I speak of Aram, we have to speak of Aram Damascus, which would be around where Abraham came from, Nahor. It's essentially, it's not Mesopotamia. It's below Mesopotamia. It's below the Euphrates River. The Euphrates comes out of the Persian Gulf. The Tigris River heads north to El Jazeera pretty fast, to the Ararat Mountains. The Euphrates River, Nahar Pirat, goes over towards the Middle East in the direction of Syria, and about 100 miles beforehand, it also takes a north towards the mountains of Turkey, towards Asia Minor. But below that area is the area that we know as our ancestral home, Arami Oved Avi. We're Aramites, essentially. We're all Aramites. Semites. There were various Aram countries. If you remember, David fought Aram Tsova, there was Aram Damascus. There were about four or five, I think, little Arams, which were all broken down into smaller kingdoms. Certainly one of the powerful kingdoms was Aram Damascus, which, not surprisingly, is centered around in the capital city, is Damascus. Now, if you remember, there was a battle, I think it was Aviam, but I don't remember exactly. It was either Aviam or his brother Asa. I think it was Aviam, who was being attacked by the northern king, by Baasha. He was in so much trouble that he made a peace treaty with Aram, with Syria, and said, if you come down and attack the northern kingdom, I could take a breather. And that's exactly what happened. And then there was two evaluations. As far as our book, as far as Sefer Malachim was concerned, it didn't bother the Navi whatsoever that he called on Syria to help. If I'm getting the story right, I might be switching the books. But I believe in Ezra's story, he found that very offensive, and he evaluated the king very badly, because the Yehudin king would call upon an outside force to help them with their struggles against their brother, even though their brother was tearing apart their country. So that's the geopolitics we have. in the north, so essentially we have a peace coming between northern and southern Israel, even though southern Israel is still friends with Syria. Northern Israel is not friends with Syria, at least as far as we could tell based on the story. What northern Israel is friends with is a peace treaty of Sidon, that is Lebanon, of today. He's married the king of Lebanon's daughter, Yezebel. So essentially the axis runs directly north and south, with the Arameans, who are in Syria, modern-day Syria, essentially, centered around Damascus, being a player that seems, if anything, to be on the side of Yehuda more than anything else, although they really haven't been a major figure. In fact, it was kind of surprising, really, to have all of a sudden, we have the story, and Eliyahu was supposed to appoint Hazael to be the king instead of Ben-Hadad, and we haven't met Hazael and Ben-Hadad. We don't even know who they are. They're names which will only be meaningful to us at a later stage, and now we're starting to get to, essentially, there's a big shadow where Syria is, not Assyria, but Syria, and this is where it's going to start to fill in, and we'll get a better sense of what Ahab was up to and what Syria, what Aram Damascus was up to. So that's a little bit of the geopolitics we have. Ben-Hadad Melech Aram. Ben-Hadad was the king of Aram. Kavatz et kol chelo shloshim ushnayim melech ito sus varachev vayal vayatzal shomron lila vayivah chemba. He got together 32 kings with chariots, and they went up to attack Shomron. So what that means is you're looking at an international treaty, and that's going to be significant. It's not just Iran as a country against Syria, Syria/ Iran as a country against northern Israel as a country, but actually he's created a coalition against Shomron to fight against it. And it's a little hard to say when this took place. My guess is sometime shortly after the famine, when things were probably pretty bad in the north in Shomron, and therefore it created a certain weakness. Now, I'm going to go outside of Tanakh for a little bit to tell you a little bit of history. And a history which is not told in this book at all, which is kind of surprising. There is, at the time of Ahab, a great battle called the Battle of Karkar. It is up closer to the Mesopotamian River. At this time, Assyria, which is centered around Nineveh probably the capital, either Ashur, the city Ashur is the capital of Ashur, of Syria, or Nineveh may be the capital, is starting to penetrate further and further towards the Mediterranean Sea. The Arameans don't like this one little bit. All these little Aramean states from Syria up to Turkey do not like this one little bit, and they form a massive coalition to battle. It was 18 kings, if I remember correctly, to battle against Assyria, and it was called the famous Battle of Karkar. Well, it was called the Battle of Karkar, but it is the famous Battle of Karkar. It's famous because there's quite a bit of literature that we've dug up that Assyria wrote about it. And we know it was a pretty lousy defeat for Assyria for the following reason, because they said they only won. So since they said we just won, we know they actually did pretty badly. Because had they actually won, it would have been their skulls were crushed and we ate their bones. And in this case, it was a battle and they ran away. That was essentially what it was, which means it was probably a pretty solid defeat for Assyria. And in fact, Assyria won't poke out its head for a long time. Among the kings that's mentioned in this great battle of Karkar is none other than Ahab of Omriland. Omriland, named after his father. It wasn't called Samaria. Well, I think once it's called Al-Samarina or something like that. Another time it's called Omriland. And Ahab is very much in the battle. That is, Ahab is on the side of Ben-Hadad, battling against the Assyrians to keep them out of Semitic territory, essentially. None of that is recorded here. It's not in any book that we have. It was certainly, at least according to Assyrian documentation, it was the largest battle, the largest gathering of kings to fight each other. It was a gargantuan, cataclysmic value battle, thousands, hundreds of thousands of dead. It's hard to say exactly how much. There's no recollection of it whatsoever in the Navi. The Navi finds it religiously insignificant. It's hard to second-guess the Navi why he finds it religiously insignificant. I'm sure he knew about it. Everybody must have known about it. It'd be not like not knowing like the Battle of Verdun. I mean, you know about it. You can decide whether it's... Or the Normandy invasion. You can decide whether it's important or not to your history book. If I'm writing a history about the economy of Norwegian states, I probably would not include D-Day in part of my history book. But certainly it would be known to pretty much anybody writing at this time. That's the guess. It's not in Divrei Yamim. It's nowhere. It's none of our books whatsoever. The question is, why was it left out? There's certainly a possibility that it wasn't known, but I don't think that's a viable possibility. One can't say why it's sensed to be religiously insignificant. However, I think that there may be a shadow here. because this isn't your usual battle. Very rarely we get, usually you'll get, you know, Melech Kush comes against fighting Melech Yisrael. Now, I'm sure that there were plenty of allegiances and allies and people, little city-states coming together to do battle, but you usually don't get that close a view of this idea of a co-joined forces. Here it's right in our faces. That is, he didn't pull together, like, you know the language that we've seen. He had 100,000 troops. He had 1,000,000 troops. He had whatever, you know, 1,000,000s, because I don't want to say 1,000,000, because that's wrong. Here you actually get this coalition of forces that Ben-Hadad gets together, and I think that may be a shadow, perhaps a mocking, a mockery of the Battle of Karkar, because again, the Battle of Karkar was, Achav was on the side of the Aramites, and yet, you know, 1 minute later, the Aramites are fast to turn and turn against him. So this may be a slight criticism of Achav's real politics, but that's just a guess on my part. I will show you that this issue comes up a little bit later, yeah.
The only comment that hits me while I was listening to you is the source that you have about the battle is from Assyria.
Assyria.
And if they lost, then they're going to make a big battle with hundreds and thousands against them.
You mean they made it bigger than it seemed? Yeah, that's true. They do mention all the kings by name, though. And it includes Ben-Hadad and Achav of Omri land. You're right. They could have presented it as more cataclysmic than it really was. So it's possible that it was a more minor event. I would assume the coalition of X amount of kings was accurate simply because they did mention kings that we were aware of at the time, including our own, and it matched about perfectly chronologically. It was like they read Tanakh and said, oh, Hadad and Achav together, that makes sense to me, but obviously they were writing a real history of the time. You're right, it's certainly possible. I should leave in the possibility that simply it was not known to our prophets. But I don't know, it's hard to say, it is a little bit outside. I would rather say that it's religiously insignificant to our prophets. And here what I'm trying to say is may have just been a tad significant in this idea of coalition forces. We're going to see the idea of coalition forces a few times in this chapter, not only on their side, but on our side, and therefore I get the feeling there's a little hint of this Battle of Karkar. I'm sorry, I should have brought in the text. I have the book, Ancient Near Eastern Text by Pritchard. I should have brought it in and read a little bit to you just to get a feel from it, so maybe we can edit it. I'll do it next time, just to get a flavor of this history, which was simply deleted by the Torah. This is, of course, one of those cases where you have to, where it's important to recognize that Tanakh is not a history book in the diaristic, in a sense of a diary, and sometimes you go looking for history that's not there, or you can't find history that is there. The Navi will cut things out and shape things around the way he wants to, because his goal is not to, you know, be a bestseller for accurate history. His goal is to tell you what God thinks about history. And apparently God either thought nothing about Karkar, or if I'm right, the great battle of Karkar, or if I'm right, I think there may be a little bit here. So getting back to the story, Ben-Hadad gathers together all of these coalition forces. Vayishlach malachim alachav melech Yisrael ha'ir. He sends him a letter. Vayomelo ko amar Ben-Hadad, so says Ben-Hadad, kaspecha uzavcha lihu. That's pretty straightforward, right? Your money and your gold, your silver and your gold, that's mine. V'nashecho v'necho tovim lihim. And your women and your good sons are mine. Or you could say your good women and your good sons are mine. It's hard to say what tovim is referring to. I don't know what that means. He didn't like the bad sons? It's a little unclear exactly what he's looking for. Or if it applies to the women, he only wants the top-rated woman, but he's not interested in, like, the it's hard to say what's going on, but it's certainly a statement. It's a statement of vassalage. He's asking here, by the way, this is classic. This is vassalage. Your money is my money. He's essentially saying that you are now going to be a vassal to me, or I will fight you. It's kind of a classic demand for vassalage. Yes?
Is it possible that he was a vassal, and that's why he joined the Battle of Karkar, and that now he was setting himself up as being more independent?
I can't say that. I don't know. I just don't know. The Battle of Karkar just lists the kings flatly, and never, the Assyrians don't know enough about internal Semitic politics to know who's the boss of who. But in this case, what you're saying is, how does that affect our understanding of the story? Though you had the statement at the end that I didn't understand. So assuming that he was a vassal at the time of the Battle of Karkar,
So that for some reason, Syria or Texas,
right,
want him to, it may just be the language, but he seems to be saying, you know, this is already a fact.
Oh, I see what you're saying. That is, I want, like, it's a informational type thing. I want you to know that all your money is mine.
I think it's more, we all know that this is all mine, and you need to remember that.
That's not my sense of things. I mean, it's absolutely possible. My sense of things is that this is more of an ultimatum, and we're going to see it becomes even more of an ultimatum in a second. It's certainly possible, or maybe it was possible that he was already a vassal, and then Achav started to pull away a little bit.
Yeah.
Both of those are possibilities, but the simple text is, this is the first time they're meeting. Aram sends forces and simply says, everything that you have belongs to me. We're going to see, by the way, and at the end, against prophetic desire, they wind up best friends. My guess is the Battle of Karkar takes place after this incident. That's my guess. Just based on a few things, also based on my knowledge of when the Karkar took place, my guess it was further into his 22-year rule. This sounds a little bit earlier on in the rule. But anyway, let's read the story and see what comes out of it. Vayan melech Yisrael vayomer kidvarcha aduni hamelech lecha ani v'chol asher li. So he puts up absolutely zero fight. He says, absolutely, you got everything that you want. He's no idiot. He's probably in a bad situation following the drought. Obviously, Aram is in a powerful situation. We'll see from the forces. And he says, it's all yours. I'm a vassal. Vayashuvu ha-malachim vayomru. And then the malachim come back, and they say like this. Ko amar ben adad lemor. Ki shalachti elecha lemor. You sent a message to me saying, kas b'cha zabacha neshachu v'anecha li titein. Sorry, when I sent you a letter, I want all of your gold and your silver and your women and your children, give them to me. So now I'm going to send all of my servants to you, that is my military forces. They're going to check your whole house. And all of the houses of your servants. Anything which you desire, all the desirable things in your eyes, yasimu v'yadam l'akachu, they're going to take and they're going to walk away with. The first thing that's confusing is it's not clear what's going on. That is, why send the second letter? The first letter said, I want everything. And the king said, Achav said, okay. So now he goes, okay, not only do I want everything, but I'm going to send people to actually take it. Okay. And now look what happens. Vayikra melech Yisrael l'chol zeknei haaretz. So the king of Israel, Achav, calls to all the elders of the land. Vayomer du'u na'ru. Look and see. Understand. Ki ra'az zem v'vakesh. This bad guy, what he wants. Ki shalach elai v'nashay l'vanay l'kaspi l'zaviv alon manti m'menu. He wanted all these things. I didn't say no. I didn't prevent him. Vayomru ela. Hold on a second. Ki shalach v'nashay. Don't listen to him. That is, he told them, he decided to call the Zakanim after the second letter. He says, essentially, what should I do? Here's the situation. And the Zakanim, his elders, say, don't listen to him. Okay.
What's Tovah mean?
Don't agree. Yoveh, to be agreeable, from the word Iva, like Iva l'moshav lo. It was desirable as a sitting place for him. So the question is, what's the difference between, first of all, why send the second letter? And second of all, why does the Melech agree to the first letter, but not agree to the second letter? The only thing which obviously strikes me is certainly not possible is that he didn't like people searching his house. Like, he was willing to send everything out, but to actually have people look through my little, my privies drawer, that I'm not willing to do. But that's not likely. Rashi says something which is, you know, Rashi quotes Midrash, and he says something which seems, you know, completely off the wall. So I'll read your Rashi, see what you can make of it. And the Rashi says something better, but I think you have to pay attention to both of them because there's a lot going on here. When Rashi quotes the Drash is usually sort of spot on, even though you have to understand it in a deeper sense. So what does Rashi say? You understand the column, right? I mean, why the double letter, and why would he agree to the first one, not the second one? I mean, I don't understand the double exchange. It's a little difficult here. So here's what Rashi says. He says like this. Kol machmar enecha yashimu biadam lakachu. on the phrase, everything that is beautiful in your eyes, everything which is desirable in your eyes, they're going to take in their hands. Rashi says, "V'halo kol harishonim divrei chamdahim." I mean, everything that he mentioned before was what he wanted: silver, money, silver, gold, women, children. I mean, what's the difference between that and kol mecham dehem? Or the question is larger: why send the second letter and get upset about it when the first letter you didn't get upset about? Elamau machmarinecha. What is machmarinecha? Chemda mitoch chemda. Something even more beautiful, more desirable than the things that you already desire. Zes sefer Torah. It's the Torah itself, that is, which is really weird, right? So what happens is, Ben-Hadad sends, he says, you know what? I don't only want all your women, your children, your gold, or your silver, which apparently Achav is okay with. I want your Sefer Torah. And now Ben-Hadad freaks out. How does Rashi quote Chazal? How does Chazal know this from the pasuk that we read on Shabbat? Achav freaks out. What did I say? Yeah. So Achav freaks out. He says, and Rashi proves this by saying the pasuk Hanechamadim Mizav Umipaz Rav. It's a nice quote of the pasuk that we read on Shabbat. That which is more beautiful, Torah Tashem Tumina Mishiva Nefesh, Hanechamadim Mizav Umipaz Rav. Amar Achav Belibo. Achav said in his heart, Davar Gadol Zemifakesh. He asks. He's asking too much now. You can have my women. You can have my children. You can have my gold. You can have the silver, but don't you take my Sefer Torah? Ein zeh sheli levadi. It's not mine to give. Shel Ziknei Yisrael, he belongs to all of the elders of Israel. Lefichach vayikra lechol Ziknei haaretz. Therefore, he calls it his kingdom. In this case, the word kingdom doesn't just mean the elders in a political sense. It means the Talmid Chachamim.
What
Talmid? Well, the whole scenario. That's bothering you. That's bothering you. Of all these things, is bothering you. The fact that you imagine Achav going, God, not the Sefer Torah. I can understand, like, not the BMW, but not the Sefer Torah. I mean, really?
Where the Sefer Torah?
Why would Achav? But it goes against everything we know about Achav. It sort of belies Achav. It's the Sefer Torah which is going to drive Achav crazy. Let's assume he has a few Sefer Torahs lying around the house. That's what's going to freak him out. And let me just read the rest of Rashi. It's unbelievable. L'ficha v'yikla v'chol z'knei aretz af al pi shahayu ovdim avodak lilim. Even though these Zekanim were idol worshippers, hayu mechavdim et haTorah. They still respected the Torah. Now, this is possible. The last statement is possible because I actually mentioned, I sort of emphasized that idea of syncretism that's going on. The people at the time, it wasn't just that they were worshipping Baal worshippers. They worshipped Hashem and Baal. If Baal was having a good day and God was having a bad day, so were Baal worshippers. If it was vice versa, then great, go the other way. When did we see this? We actually saw this with Achav himself. Don't forget that his second in command is his wife, Izebel, who's the head of Baal worship or Asherah worship. And yet he's got a guy who's the head of his house, whose name is Avod Yahu, who managed to save the last 100 prophets of God. Achav plays it both ways. So that idea that I've got Zekanim, that both, you know, they both have Avodah Galilim and they also love Sefer Torah, should not completely surprise us. But the whole scenario is, the question is that the pshat? Is that really what's going on? I mean, is it really the Torah that, and that's all Rashi does, that's all he explains. Rashi's trying to show the difficulty. It's not the word Nechamadim which bothers him, it's the fact that there's this double letter, and at first Achav is compliant, and then he's not compliant, but what's really weird is the double letter itself. What more did Ben-Hadad ask for the second time than the first time? Radak answers the issue beautifully, and yet I think it's important for us to recall Rashi, because when Rashi brings down a Medrash, he usually has a good idea in mind. Rashi, anybody want to guess what Radak's going to say? Radak, if you take a look at the two letters, they are slightly different. Look at the two letters. The first one in Pasuk Gimel, and the second one in Pasuk Hey. Gimel, I'll emphasize it here to make it a little bit more straightforward, but you should see, but you probably see it. Vayomelo Kohamar ben Adag Kaspacha Uzavcha Lihu. Vinashecha Uvanecha Tovim Lihim. In Pasuk Hey, it says as follows. Kohamar ben Adag Limor, Kishalachti Elech Limor, Kaspacha Uzavcha Vinashecha Uvanecha Li Titain. What's the difference?
Well, the one he says, I'm taking them, the other says, give them to me. That part you'll give him.
I like.
First time he's making a statement, but he's not asking.
Yeah, that is ostensibly your house is my house, but he's not moving in. See, that's a theoretically, if I wanted to and I needed some cash, you were going to have to make some good long distance, low interest rate loans because that's my money. But nobody thought that just somebody becomes a vassal because they want to keep their money and their soldiers. The idea is if the king demands money, okay, then you can give money. But in the second letter, Ben-Hadad is going beyond the normal standards of vassalage. What?
I'm collecting.
I mean, that's a little bit. And by the way, that's what the word key is. Do you see that word at the beginning of key? When he says, you misunderstood me. When this is what Ben-Hadad says, ki shalachti elecha, when I sent that letter to you, litein. You want to emphasize that word litein? You misunderstood the deal, Mr. Achav. I wasn't saying that your money theoretically belongs to mine. I'm telling you that I'm going to pick it up tomorrow. That's something. Now that is pshat. Now what's that? Yeah, I'm going to actually send them to come and get it. Now you can understand why, first of all, Ben-Hadad sent me the second letter, because obviously either he feels he was misunderstood, or more likely, that is, you could say that, what? Yeah, but then the question is, let's assume that the first letter was written as he sent it, and all he said was, Kaspachana Shecha Lihu, then you could either, what is he, Ben-Hadad is saying, oh, that's what I really meant. But let's say that's not really what it meant. Let's say he offered a standard vassalage. The question is, why would he then change the letter? And I think the answer seems very obvious. Why take the... Well, there must be some good metaphor. Why take the cherry when you could have the whole... What is that? Right. I know there's a... What? There's a great metaphor here about why taking one thing when you could have the whole thing. But I can't remember what... Why buy the something when I can have my own farm? What's the expression?
Why buy the cow
and get
the milk?
No, it's the other way. Why take the milk when you can buy the whole cow? I think that's the idea. Why should I squeeze this guy when I could just take the whole thing and walk off with it? I think what you're seeing here is Ben-Hadad is, ooh, he's a happy man. See, normally you send a letter of vassalage, one army sends his armies forward, the other army, they do a little this kind of thing, a little pounding on the chest, and then you sort of work out a deal. You know who's going to win or lose, but it's like going to the Arab Shuk. I don't know if anybody remembers buying an Arab Shuk. You don't buy it for what you want to pay for. You don't buy it what they want to sell it for. You meet somewhere in the middle. That's what the vassalage is all about. Because if a king, you have to think about it, the whole state of vassalage, people always ask the question, I surround the ear to conquer it. And then I send a letter and say, I'll leave if you pay me off 100,000, whatever. If you can conquer it, why not just stay? And conquer it and get all the money. And if you can conquer it, then why should the guy give in? Because the truth is, nobody likes to gamble. Nobody wants to take the losses. But what you do is you play this little game, everybody shows what they got, and you try to leave with the deal that you're satisfied with. My feeling is that Achav, you know, when Achav sends back a letter the next day and says, you know, yours... Ben-Hadad says, wait a second, you know, why take the milk when I can have the cow? So Ben-Hadad sends this letter and says, you didn't understand me. What I really meant to say was. Now, you could say that that's actually what he meant and he just phrased it wrong. But keep in mind, the Navi is willing to change, what somebody said. You see what I'm saying? But the Navi is willing to massage the text a little bit to have it make his point. If the Navi wanted to really say that he was just misunderstood it, then he would have written the letter, rewritten the letter the first time. He'd have to go through this whole process. I believe that there's a real change here, and I think the Navi is trying to show that, in fact, the letter did change. The letter probably changed because Achav folded so fast. And then when Achav realizes that it's no joke and he's going to lose everything he has, that's when Achav says, you know what, I deal too fast. Now it's, obviously I gave away too much, and now I guess I have no choice but to go to war. But he calls this kingdom together to see whether it's the right thing. Whether that indicates that he was a weak man or not, I don't know. So, but Doc's understanding of this is beautiful. Straightforward shot, very nicely done. But why would Rashi, Rashi certainly knew these things. He was not unaware of these things, although Radak lived certainly after Rashi. Could be Radak saw certain things 100 years after Rashi. Could be Radak saw things that Rashi did not understand. Radak is from the Spanish school, even though he emigrated to Provence. But he was certainly from the Spanish school, so they certainly knew things that Rashi was not aware of in France. Nonetheless, if you look at it carefully, you do really see that there is a difference between the two letters. Why go out of your way to say that Achav is upset about the Torah? Just because the word Machamadim? My feeling is like this. Nevi'im are going to start talking to Achav. They're Nevi'im who are going to come and start to help Achav shortly against his battle. And the question is, why would Nevi'im trying to be helping Achav? In fact, at the very end of chapter ago, right before Eliyahu runs away because he's ever wants his neck, God says, I want you to put on your battle stuff and I want you to run in front of Achav's chariot. I think the sense here is that Ahav is, to God's mind, redeemable. That there is a person here that can be worked with. And again, this is sort of like, you know, when you read Gemara, so Ahav is irredeemable. He's one of the kings that lost Olam Haba. When the Torah says, Kol Yisrael Yisrael Mechef Olam Haba, and excludes a few people, Ahav is on the list of the people who lost Olam Haba. But not at this stage. And I think that's what Chazal want to say. That there's something in Ahav, even though he's an avodah, avodah klilim, there's some core and kernel to Ahav where if you show him that God is with you and that God is going to help you out, that there's a way to turn him. Because it's better to turn somebody, and it's a famous medrash. I think we say it on Rosh Hashanah, "Ki lo tachbots b'mota rasha k'im yashuvu v'chiyu." I'm probably quoting that wrong, but that's the pasuk that we say on Rosh Hashanah. Dedicate. God doesn't want anybody punished for their sins, as much as he'd like them to do tshuva and have them to come back from even death penalty sins. And that's my sense here. And I'm sort of foreshadowing. I guess I could have let that come out naturally, but I think Rashi is bringing this down because he's trying to show that Ahav is not—it's not black and white. That Ahav has a real love of Torah as well. If only he could be steered in the right direction. Let's see whether he could be steered in the right direction. Yeah.
I think if, you know, from reading through all of Ahav's adventures, that Ahav was actually a good king in that he cared about the people and he cared about their will.
Yeah, I think so.
And so, you know, some of this other stuff, like with Nabal's vineyard,
That was
Jezebel. He just sort of went along with it.
Yeah, well, you're jumping ahead of chapter, though. We haven't gotten there.
But in general, he wasn't like Haman. You know, he wasn't evil and awful. He was just sort of laissez-faire in this religion thing. He may have had a respect for the unique culture of Israel, just felt you had to be modern. And
have a respect for the culture of other people.
Right.
I agree with you completely, and he was successful, and I believe the people probably did like him by and large, although probably during the drought it wasn't so good. Right? Nobody likes a king when the economy is bad. Mm-hmm. It's going to make a difference how good he is. I would want to just comment on one thing, or I don't want to say correct, because I don't know if I'm right or wrong. I think we'll find, and I'm foreshadowing now probably two classes in advance, that when he makes the mistake with Yezebel, with Nabot HaKarmeli, he steals somebody's property, sets up a bogus court, a kangaroo court, and convicts him. You're saying that was Yezebel and not Ahav. I want to show you from the text that after that point, Ahav is no longer redeemable.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Nabi will say, because you did this thing, we're not talking anymore. And I think that that's... I think what we'll see, in fact, is that the minute that he turns against his own people, the minute that you want to worship, you know, it's like the Tower of Babel thing. You know, you want to fight against God, I can handle that. The minute that you start killing each other, that's when the big punishment comes down and God has to start destroying. I think we'll see that after Nabot HaKarmeli, when he the kangaroo court where he has him murdered for nothing, we'll see that the Navi stops talking to him anymore. We're going to see a difference in the attitude of the Nevi'im to Ahav before and after Nabot HaKarmeli, and for very much the reasons that you're saying. As soon as you turn against your own people to the point where you're willing to kill your own people, there's nothing to talk about as far as kings go anymore. But, you know, there's no redemption here. What a worship by the gods, we'll talk about it. We'll work on it. We'll punish you. We'll figure something out. The minute you start murdering your own people, I'll get myself a new king. That's exactly, I believe, what is going to happen. But we'll wait to see that in probably not even next week, probably in a few weeks. Let's read on. Verse 9. Vayomer l'malachei ben Hadad. So he says to the messengers of Ben Hadad, Imru la'adoni ha'melech kol asher shalachta l'abdecha v'arishona ha'aseh. I'm willing to do what you said in the first place. V'adavar hazeh lu chaloso. But do not think I'm going to listen to your second letter. Which means he's not willing to be tricked into the idea that's what Ben Hadad wanted. He says there was a difference between the two letters. The first letter I'll go for, but forget about the second letter. So they sent back word to Ben Hadad. And very difficult pasuk. First of all, I want to point out that swear. You'll probably notice that this is sort of your classic swear. So should God do to me. The difference here, by the way, is the plural. Take a look at the plural here.
Oh,
it doesn't say, well, no, ours also says Elohim, but when we swear, it's Koyaseh Elohim, v'cho Yosif. I'm going to ask you to take the time to show you that, but when David swears and other people swear, it says Choya Aselohim Choyosif. This is one of the classic proofs that the word Elohim is singular, because when we swear, whenever there's a Jew swearing in Tanakh, it's Choya Aseh Elohim in the singular. So should God do, Cho Yosef, and so should Kedidu do. Oh, when Izebel makes this swear, and so does Ben Hadad, it's Cho Yasun Elohim, Cho Yosefun, showing you that when they said the word Elohim, they meant plural. When we said the word Elohim, we meant singular. One of the classic cases that where you can really prove that Elohim is absolutely singular, and you can prove it textually and grammatically, so you don't have to try to figure out, it's not even apologetics. It's essentially straight shot, but most people are, when they have something to prove, so they don't listen so well. But anyway, so he swears, Im yishpok kafar shomom misholim. So the question, what does that mean? So the shalim here probably does not mean foxes. Sha'al is mi madad b'sha'alo aretz. It's a pasuk in Tehillim. The mi something b'yad, the pasuk means who measures with the, who is like God who measures the earth in their hands? It's actually from not until it's Yeshayahu. Shalim is probably a foot, and it's a foot measurement. It's used against the word yad. It's a measuring foot. The truth is like today's foot. So the word sha'al is probably a pasuk, and what it means is
maybe it's a fox's tail.
It could be, and Radak brings down both possibilities, but what it seems to be is, the idea is that there won't be enough dust on the land of Israel to hold all the feet of my soldiers. That's how the Radak explains it. It's a very fancy, flowery language, but that's by and large how it comes out. The Chol Asher Biraglai, all of those who are in my foot soldiers. That is you haven't seen nothing yet. I'm going to bring in so many people, you're not going to have any territory free. What?
This is a threat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so it's more than a threat. He's going to do it. Yeah. Vayan Melech Yisrael Vayomru Dabru. Oh, yeah, it is a threat. Absolutely. Look what, and then Melech Yisrael comes back and says like this. Dabru Al Yitalel Choger Kim Fateach. How about that for words which are so simple you can't understand what that means. Dabru, those who talk. Al Yitalel Choger. Do not let the one who is Choger, means who is armed, or, you know, with wearing a battle armaments, let him not praise Kim Fateach, like one who has opened things up. It's hard to say what this means without going to Mefarshim and going to the Targum Yonatan. So I'll just tell you what they all translate, and they all pretty much agree what it means. It is, it's easy to boast before you win the battle. That's essentially how. How does the English translate this? I'm curious.
It's pretty much that. It says, let not him that girds on his harness boast himself, as he that takes it off.
As he that, right. Kim Fateach, exactly, like that. Fateach meaning the one who's putting it on has nothing to talk about. If the one who takes it off, he knows he's won the battle. But until he, or in other expressions, it ain't over until the fat lady sings. That's one expression. Or don't count your chickens before they lay their eggs. All kinds of possible expressions. But he's saying, oh yeah, I'd like to see you try. That's probably really what he's saying. Obviously, this was an expression that was well known at the time. I want to show you something. I want to mention something very interesting. I read in Rabbi Wurman, Rav Shlomo Wurman is my Rebbe. He was here once to talk Kristallnacht a few years ago. His daughter, daughter-in-law Miriam Wurman, lives in Teaneck. She is actually a geneticist as well. I don't know if you...
She did about three weeks...
Oh, she did? Was it on her book about science? And so I don't know if... In the book, she mentions the Kohen gene, which is just fascinating. You know, that's really almost apocalyptic, really, because the idea of, you know, one of the things that the Gemara talks about in the Rambam Pasuk of Halacha, that one of the things that will indicate that Mashiach's on its way is the Nevi'im will come and they'll say who's a Kohen and who's not a Kohen. They'll pick out. And everybody's like, how are they going to do that? And now apparently what the Rambam didn't know is they're going to use genetics. So it's a very, it has a certain, for me, I'm a big misnagit, but I have to tell you, even as a big misnagit, it sends chills up my spine when I think about that psak. I think about what Miriam Wurman wrote. And she also wrote that the other people who have the Kohen genes are Syrians. So something that you should know, Arami Ovedovi is quite serious. We are very, very closely related to the Arameans. And it's important to understand as we go through the chapters. We're not really close to the Phoenicians of Sidon, of Lebanon. That's a nice deal with the Holy Zebel kind of thing. But we're not really related. You could sense, by the way, from where they are geographically, that a lot of it was the early Plishtim. They weren't even called Plishtim. They were called Phoenicians, who were coming off the Aegean Islands, and they would merge into the Canaanite culture of Lebanon, and they really created their own little thing. I'm not saying that they weren't Semitic, but certainly Israel was close with them. But the Arameans, where we came from, you know, Nahor, Haran, all of these places, that's our bread and butter. I mean, that's where Lavan, you know, Lavan and Betuel, that's where all of them went. These were our people. And it was very interesting when Miriam Mormon pointed out that the Cohen gene still apparently has a certain, has also been identified in a certain portion of Syrians. There's a real close relationship here, and of course, like many brothers and sisters or cousins, it's usually more trouble than it's worth, right? It's, well, you're friends, it's okay, but you can't pick your relatives, so that's what's going to cause much of the friction. But you should understand that they speak the same language. They really do. You could sense that they're familiar with each other's little chachmas. There's a shared relationship going on. Again, this is one of those things where you can't read Tanakh too simplistically. When you read Tanakh, Israel's by itself, everybody else is not even around. God, Israel having anything to do with the Syrians? You know, never. Obviously, you could see that they go to the same universities, they talk the same talk, they probably hang out in cafes together. There's, you just don't see that in Tanakh. But yet, as you see that in little pieces like this, that they speak the same language, even though it's not a standard language, it's flowery, poetic language. You don't see day-to-day communications, but you have to assume that they're there. Otherwise, they wouldn't know what they were... They wouldn't know what they were talking about. How that affects assimilation at the time, syncretism of multiple religions, these are all hard things to say, but certainly they spoke the same language. Anyway, continuing on. You'd bet. Vayhi kishmo at the dvar zeh, v'hu shotev, v'hu hamalachim basukot, v'yom al avadav simu v'yasimu al yer. So he is apparently already plundered into Israel, which shouldn't surprise anybody, because he wouldn't be making these threats unless he already had soldiers. He's sitting in Sukkot, which I assume, I don't know if there's something, whenever you see the word Sukkot, you're wondering, is there something else going on? But I think the idea here is just a temporary camp. There may be something going on beyond the Pshat, but I don't know what it is. He said, go take the city, and they went and they besieged the city. The word Shoteh, of course, is very important because he's being painted as a drunkard, And here's a Navi who comes to Achav. Now, who is this Navi? We don't know. Is it Eliyahu? I suppose so, but I doubt it. Eliyahu probably wouldn't show his face because Yizebel wants him dead. But what's interesting is, even though Yizebel wants him dead, and you think Yizebel now has the upper hand and a Navi would never talk to Achav, wait a second. Again, don't read the Torah as black and white. Yizebel wants him dead, everybody's dead. No. They're Nevi'im that's starting to work back, which shouldn't surprise you because Eliyahu put in a nice floor and light show. Achav is impressed by it, and Achav listens to Eliyahu. Again, there's this struggle between good and evil in Achav. So he goes to Achav, whoever this is, we'll never know. Michayu, yeah. And I'll tell you why that's so poignant, because Michayu will come up in two chapters from now after the incident where Achav does the kangaroo court and kills Navot, and Michayu curses him in the worst of senses. If this was Michayu, that creates a real tension between a Navi who's willing to work with you or a Navi who won't even communicate with you. And Achav hates Michayah, we'll see. As soon as he finds out that Michayah's in the business, he doesn't want him, and in the end he puts him in jail to be killed, essentially. If this is Michayah, that's a very poignant statement. Is it really Michayah? I don't think so, because they would have mentioned his name, because they mentioned his name afterwards. But that very... What's that? Yeah, that's correct. But my question with rabbinic sources like that is, are they trying to tell you that that's pshat, which is possible, or are they trying to emphasize the poignancy of the story? I don't know in this case. It could be both, by the way. I don't know if they had a mesorah that we weren't aware of, but the implications of it being Michayu are very important. But I don't think we'll understand those implications until after we get to chapter 22. But anyway, let's continue ahead. Vayomer kol amar Hashem, haraita kol ha'amon ha'gadol zeh. You see all these forces aligned against you? Today, they're gone. They're gone. You're going to get you to take them all. And then you'll know that I am God. Who's going to do this? Yeah, Achav is like a little believing. He can't quite get himself to believe, right? He hears it, so instead of going out and fighting right away, it's like, really, who's going to pull this off? With the children of the officers of the nations. Who are these officers of the nations? We've never met them before. We don't know who they are. So according to some opinions, they're the officers of the, they're the children of the only firm people around. The other possibility, which Radak brings down, is what happened was when you took a vassal, and at some point Achav was a very powerful guy who had vassals himself, what you do is you keep one of the children of the king in your little hometown. That's a good way of making sure that the vassals stay kosher. This is found all over ancient Near Eastern texts. Whenever there was a vassalage, one of the sons went over to the, usually the Bechor went over, he was raised in the house of Achav to ensure, first of all, to ensure it was blackmail, but there was another political motivation, to ensure that the next king sitting on that vassal's country would be loyal, would be a loyalist to the people in charge. And this was done all over the place. It was done in Egypt, it was done in Mesopotamia, this was common practice. According to some, these are people who were vassals, the children of the people who were still vassals to Achav. And here I want to remind you again of what I said before. This is the second time that we're seeing this idea of, this is very unusual, you won't find this anywhere else. Once again, you have this idea of coalition forces, and whether this is a reference to the Battle of Karkar, I couldn't tell you, but it's certainly distinctive and it deserves a note. The fact that Aram has his vassals and Achav has his vassals. Vayomer mi yasor milchama. So he says, who's going to run this battle? Who's going to lead the battle? Vayomer ata. It's going to be you. Now the question's very strange, because Achav, yeah, I mean, of course, why wouldn't the king? One gets the sense that maybe, so I'll tell you what Rashi says, or either Rashi or Radak, because Radak also knows this drash about how he loved the Torah. He said, maybe I'm not a good enough person. I'm listening to you, but because I know God's pretty upset with me, because all those terrible things I do, if I go out to battle, I'm going to lose. So maybe we should be picking somebody from her, and he'll be able to lead Yeshua. This is another one of those drashic things which indicates that if Achav isn't from yet, there's some sense that there's a God who cares about good and evil and right and wrong. Vayifkod et narei sarem, you know, so they counted up all these narim. Vayu matayim shnayim v'shloshim. I can tell you right away, that's a funny number. Matayim shnayim v'shloshim. It's 232, but what's really weird about it is that's not the way Hebrew is written. Hebrew is written from down to up. It should have been Shnayim Shloshim U'Matayim. That's standard Hebrew. So I want you to remember this number, 232, and how it's weirdly stated. It really sounds like 200, stop, 32. I'll show you why that's possible, that's true. I'm going to continue on. V'achareim pakad kol ha'am kol b'nei Yisrael shivat alavim. And then he gathered all his Jewish forces, and he found out there were 7,000. Does anybody remember why that number 7,000 is important? So here, without losing your place, go back to where Hashem says that he's going to punish Bnei Yisrael, and the only people who are going to survive are ones who didn't bow down to Baal. Does anybody remember anybody want to guess what the number is of the people in Baal 7? That would be the correct guess. I don't want to tell you. It's in the previous chapter. Now, is this number, was there really 7,000? Were these 7,000? Radak says maybe these were actually the 7,000 from people that Achav went and get to make sure. Again, I'm going to go into battle. God wants to go to battle. What I'll do is I'll find the 7,000 that are still eating kosher food, send out a letter, get all the people who are still not dying down to Baal, and they'll run the battle for me. Again, if you go with this idea, Achav is sensitive to the idea that it is the people who haven't bowed down to Baal who should win. Once again, it's the idea of, can we redeem Achav? Is there a human being here that is worthy of redemption? And is there something in Achav which is worthy of redemption? And we'll just continue ahead. Tetzayin, Vayitzu Batzaharan, they go out in the afternoon, Ben Hadad Shoteh Shikur. The middle of a battle, middle of the day of the battle, 12 o'clock, it's brand noon, it's not even nighttime party. I can understand him, you know, playing those beer games at night, but 12 o'clock, he's having one of those 13 martini lunches, right? So he's drunk in the middle of the battle. Radak here again points out something which should have been obvious to us from the first and second letter. Ben-Hadad is a megalomaniac. He's nuts. He's got one of those nutty king things going on. He's so confident, so hubristic, so egotistic. I don't think he's saying this because he was an alcoholic. I don't think that interests the Navi. What interests the Navi is the implications of a human being who would come into battle and be willing to get drunk on the day of a battle is a king who doesn't really think that there's going to be much of an issue here. An overconfident king, a king who really doesn't think too hard. That's the picture that Ben-Hadad is being portrayed as, and I think that's a pretty fair picture. So he's drunk. Oh, by the way, how many kings are there in verse 16? There are 32 in his, which means it matches up to the number 32 of 232 that we had by the ones who are supporting, the children who are supporting Achav's vassalage. Now, Achav's vassalage was apparently 232, so I'm not sure what to make out of that number. On the other hand, my tendency is to divide it between 200, stop, and 32, with 32 being the number of actual vassals and 200 probably being secondary, not princes, but more secondary secondary vassalage positions, cousins, second brothers, whatever it was. Just that number 32 is too significant. Or if it was 232, the Navi certainly is trying to separate it out to compare Achav, what Achav has, versus what Ben-Hadad has. And again, that's the idea of this vassalage and this kind of thing, which to my mind points to Karkar, but of course I can't prove that because the word Karkar doesn't show up in Tanakh anywhere. Anyway, continuing on. So these vassals, vassal children went out first. People coming out of Shomron. I'm going to read that again. If they're coming out for peace, what should do? Tifsum chayim.
Take them alive.
Ve'im l'milchama yatsu chayim tifsum. Oh, so how are you reading that then?
Kill them.
Again, interestingly enough, Radak is into this whole... What's that? How does it translate?
It says, if they are come out for peace, take them alive. And if they are come out for war, take them alive.
That is Radak.
He's drunk.
What?
He's drunk.
What's that?
He's singing the line here. He's drunk.
You're right. That's also, absolutely. The Radak paints it in the same way. Take him alive, because the Radak says he's so egotistical that he can't even imagine that anybody would be coming out to war against him. Radak's playing on this whole egotistical, overconfident king here. I've never heard the drunk thing, but it's very funny, and it sounds like it, right? It's a beer song. Tisum chayim chayim tisum. Tisum chayim chayim tisum. It's very nice. I have to say, I still tend towards the idea of let their lives take them. I don't know why. I just like that. I don't know. Do we have another translation? How do the pinks go with this? How does this one go?
If for war they have come out alive, shall you seize them?
What about peace?
If for peace they have come out, seize them alive.
Oh, so it keeps the word changed, but it comes out to the same thing, which means let them live.
Interesting note.
Yeah, go ahead.
That the above now adds that Ben Hadad spoke drunkenly and therefore reversed the order of the words.
Very nice, very beautiful, good. Wow, Tov Shekivanu on all the possible answers. I have to say, I still like the idea that maybe, you know what, actually, I thought I liked the idea, but maybe I liked it. I know the drunk thing is very attractive. What's that? Oh, in Ferdinand and Isabella's court, he probably did know a lot of drunken Spaniards. Yeah, that's true. All right, let's continue on. Yeah, that's very. I have to say, I never saw it before. It's very nice, very nice. Pasuk Yud-Tet. The Elu Yatsu. In which case, we're painting not so much, an egotistical king, but it's a very, very foolish one. Maybe Achashverosh-like, almost, to be honest. The Elu Yatsu Min Ha'ir Na'arei Sarayam Dinot V'Chayal Asher Achrayam, and there was army afterwards. V'Yaku Ish Isho, and every man killed, the person who came out to grab them. By Anusu Aram, you're defaming Israel. Aram runs away, and they're chased by Israel. Vayimaleit ben Hadad melech Aram al susu farashim. So he manages to get away. Now the word susu farashim is a little bit strange. I mean, how many chariots could you run away from? So there are those who say it was one sus and two farashim, and that was the only thing that's escaped. Or could you say he got away with the cavalry? It's possible. Vayetzei melech Israel vayachet asus v'et arechev. Apparently, whatever cavalry and chariots were still there, he destroyed. What's interesting here, by the way, is the king only comes out when? This is Achav. The only time he comes out is when? After the war is already going in their way, which means he did not listen to the prophet. The prophet, he said, "Mi yasor milchama, who should lead the battle?" And they said, "You should." And he didn't listen. So again, here we have these issues where Achav, he's straddling the line. He's not taking any chances. He believes in the Navi, but he doesn't believe in him. The Navi told him to go out and fight in battle, and he went out and fought, but only after everything was nice and sure. They defeated them, a good defeat. Go and strengthen yourself. I'll show you where you should know what you need to do. Because by the end of this year, you think that all you have to do is win one little battle and it's all over? It's not true. Now's the time. God gave you an itty-bitty miracle. That's all he did. He gave you time to breathe. Now what I want you to do is pull together your forces because Melech Aram has not had it with you. He will be back. And by the way, Achav will. So one gets the sense where Achav is listening to the prophet. Or the prophet, again, you have this thing where the prophets are coming and talking, and we don't know who this prophet is. Vayigash HaNavi. But this prophet is having an extended relationship. Is it Elisha? Doubt it. Is it Eliyahu? Almost impossible. Is it Michayu? It's possible. But there is a real relationship here with Achav learning, struggling, trying to be frum, and then in some cases trying not as hard as he should to be frum. And that brings us to the second battle of Aram, where things go very badly for, well, things go very well for Achav politically, but spiritually they go very bad for Achav. And that looks like we'll have to continue next year. That will continue next year.